This is the Night Shift on Triple M. Adam Shan filling in for Luke Boner. I made a podcast for the Listener app called The Great Qantas Hoax. It tells the story of the 1971 plot where a man called Mr. Brown called Qantas and said he'd planted a bomb on QF-755 to Hong Kong. It was a hoax, but Qantas still paid up the $500,000 reward. I thought making the podcast would be interesting to know what a modern-day pilot would do if there was a bomb on a plane. So I got retired A380 Captain James Nixon to tell us what happens in modern times with bomb threats and bomb hoaxes. And James is on the line to discuss this very issue. Good morning, James.
Good morning, Adam. And yes, we learned a lot from Mr. Brown. Pretty much that's one of the few hijack situations where we learned a lot in a short period of time.
What in particular was learnt from that one?
Well, so many things were learnt. I think the thing that we've decided to find out straight away is whether a bomb is real or not. So a huge amount of work has gone on behind the scenes for all airlines and police forces. They now work very, very closely together. And so pretty much they've got hotlines between each other. So as soon as a threat comes in, it's immediately triaged by some professional people. In Qantas's case, you know, you just get someone answering a switchboard and they say, you know, put me through to the chairman or else. Well, those sort of things don't happen like that anymore. And as soon as a threat is raised on the airline, then a lot of things go on behind the scenes so that the pilots are presented with a pretty good chance of whether it's a red threat or a green threat.
Okay, so what happens from there? What's a red threat? What's a green threat?
Well, a red threat's really serious, and we better take notice of this one. A green threat is maybe a generic threat on the airline, which happens a fair bit with dissatisfied customers. In a country like Australia, most of our threats are family court issues, more so than terrorist issues, where disgruntled fathers put the kids on the flight and then call in a threat so that they think that it's going to upset the wife or the ex-wife when she hears what's going on.
So How often does that happen?
Well, more often than, certainly they don't get reported.
You don't hear about it?
No, they don't get reported, but it happens more often than you would imagine probably.
I guess the problem here is the more you talk about this stuff, it's a case of monkey see, monkey do.
I've got a lot of notes in front of me that have got red lines next to them saying, you know, I'm not allowed to tell you about this or that. We've got code words and all sorts of things like that that we have to keep quiet and only use within the industry.
Yeah, don't mention the B word.
We won't. Passengers don't like that either.
So what happens with the crew when it's established that it's a red threat, there is a bomb on the plane? What happens to the crew? How do they deal with this whole situation?
Well, there's not really a bomb on the plane yet. It's just presented to them as a threat that is identified on their flight. And so they might, if it gets to that point, it's pretty serious. And there's a few different ways that it can happen. And, of course, we've got different locations. Is it happening on the gate before pushback? Is it when the airplane's taxiing on the ground? If it's airborne, what phase of flight is it in? And they usually determine whether there's two different things. There's either a generic threat or a time threat where the bomber will actually tell you what time the bomb is going to go off. And if you remember back to the IRA blasts in London in the 1970s and 80s, it was a big thing to raise a bomb threat with a real bomb that did go off, but they would give a time. And remember, you'd always hear those police reports saying that it was a coded phone call so that police would take notice of it. One particular one was the Sheraton Hotel in London, where they used to regularly blow it up every Saturday night whenever there were four weddings happening in the four different ballrooms, just to inconvenience everybody in the hotel. And eventually one time they did put a bomb outside and blow all the windows in. So when you get these coded threats, if there's a time factor to it, then there's the way the pilots treat it is completely different to if there's not a time factor. If it's on climb and it's a we assume it could be a pressure-based bomb, as you've probably remembered in the Mr. Brown case, there was a threat of a
barometric bomb.
Bomb, and there's two pressures that we deal with. There's the cabin pressure inside the cabin where the people are, where we pressurise the plane to, in the old days, about 8,400 feet, which was most aeroplanes. And then we have the new aeroplanes like the A380, where instead of going up to Mount Kosciuszko, we go to Falls Creek, and the 787 Boeing now goes only to Mount Buller, which is about 5,200 feet. So those internal pressures affect bombs that are inside the pressurized cargo and passenger area of the aeroplane. Then there's the external areas, which is what they were worried about in the Mr. Brown case, because, of course, this was one of the first altitude bombs, and they weren't too sure where it was. Now, if it's in an unpressurized part of the aeroplane, which is somewhere in the wings or in the underneath where the wheels hide when they're in flight, if it's in there, that's an unpressurized section. So the first thing you do is you don't exceed whatever pressure you're at now. So if we're climbing and we get the message, we'll press altitude hold and hold the aeroplane at that level. And we'll also put the pressurization into manual mode, and we'll stop the pressurization, raising the cabin to the normal cruise. So if it's going to come up to 5,800 feet in an A380, and we're climbing up and it's slowly going from sea level up at a rate that people's ears don't get affected, we will then go to manual and lock it off at whatever it is, and it might be 3,500, 4,000 feet by that stage.
Okay. Now, it's all about finding the bomb. The crew swings into action. They have various sectors of the plane that they're responsible for. They find the bomb. What happens next?
Right. So we've got a... you've jumped five or six steps in that point, but
yeah.
I understand.
This is radio.
This is radio, and we've found a bomb, which has never been... I don't think it's ever been done in reality in life before. But where your listeners think of the cabin crew as giving cabin service... trust me, that's only number 11 in their job description. The best thing they are is bomb disposal experts, and also firefighters, as well as first aiders, as far as a pilot is concerned. So they immediately swing into action. Each flight attendant has an area that, prior to the passengers getting on the aeroplane, they have swept their area, and they're also in charge of about 35 passengers each. And so they will very quickly do a check for a bomb, and you're now telling me they've found one. So if they've located that bomb, and we are not assuming it's a time bomb, then we're going to maybe move that bomb to an area where, if it does go off, it's not going to do much damage to the aircraft, and as little damage to passengers as possible.
In other words, behind the engine somewhere.
Yes, yes. And
we won't say where that space is, but there's a spot on every plane. I found this remarkable, but this is the way these planes are designed.
That's right. Well, we've learnt from a thing called the Sioux City crash. And remember, we never listen to, never watch air crash investigations anymore.
No,
because
you wouldn't.
Because we've studied every single crash in our training. But the Sioux City accident or crash that occurred with the aircraft that crashed into the cane field with the loss of about 120 people, I think it was, the listeners will remember that the middle engine failed, and that also took out the hydraulics and made it impossible almost to fly that airplane. And three guys did a marvellous job and did a very good job of saving as many as they could. What we've learnt from that, and that was way back in the 1980s, I suppose, was that you don't put all the services in one place together. So you don't want to have a situation where you have one loss of a hydraulic system which takes out the others, which then makes the plane unflyable. But we also want to make sure that we've got a location in the aeroplane where no hydraulics or air conditioning or electrical services go near, so that if there, we put a bomb there and it goes off, the plane is still flyable. So we'll put that bomb in a special area called the least bomb location.
the special name. Pull the flap, there it is.
I can't remember what it's called, but it's something like...
Doesn't matter.
At least resistance or something. But anyway, it's a place where we put the bomb and we prepare that area before we move the bomb. Well, firstly, we've got to make sure that the bomb hasn't got anything underneath it that's going to blow up as soon as we move it. So the cabin crew have a special way of determining that, and I'm not going to tell you that either. And then we're going to prepare the area. We're going to put the bomb on a heap of baggage or seat cushions, and we're going to build up an area with liquids and blankets, and we're going to make an area that we can put the bomb and sit it there close to this, and then we're going to identify where it is, because we're going to pack a huge heap of stuff around it to try and get the bomb to go out of the airplane.
Right.
The pilots are going to assist that, because we're going to put the airplane in a pressurization level where the cabin pressure is going to be about 2,500 feet different to the airplane. So anything will go out. We want to get the bomb to go out of the airplane, not into the airplane, if you can imagine. So we want the internal pressure to be more than the external pressure. And so we manage that. And, of course, we're trying to descend down in steps while we're doing that. And then we'll pack that whole area up and make it very, very safe, meanwhile moving the passengers away from it so that...
As safe as a bomb can be on a plane.
Safe as...
I'd rather snakes, frankly.
And then we're going to sit back and see what happens. Well, there's two ways of handling this. If you tell me when the bomb's going to go off, my job as the pilot is to be the fastest pilot that's ever flown an airplane, and my job is to be parked, passengers and everyone evacuated, and I want to be sitting up in the bar with a martini, shaken, not stirred, watching the firemen deal with this, right? Because pilots aren't very good at, we don't want to be involved in emergencies, so we'd much rather watch it. So if they say it's going to happen at 2 o'clock and it's now 1 o'clock, I'm going to be on the ground, parked, and everyone off and away from it before the bomb goes off. If we don't know when the bomb's going to go off, and don't worry, we're still getting data from the ground, because by this stage, as soon as we've been told by Master Control that they're working on this, these guys go into a special boardroom and they're linked with all the police and everybody. So they're developing more and more information as it goes.
Yep.
But my job will be to get the airplane down so
correct.
That I'm in charge of the pressurization. So I want to get it down close to my, so I can start working the pressurization levels.
But if the bomb actually does go off, all these planes are designed that you can land the wreck, which I find remarkable. So people can have great confidence that even if this the worst case scenario, the designers have already thought about this. And your job is to land the wreck, which I find remarkable. Scary thought, but it's comforting too.
In an aeroplane like an A380, because it was the biggest ever built, they over-engineered with over-redundancy. So it's got 5 flight control computers, and you don't only need one, and it only ever uses one. So you've got all this backup that's going to happen. But what you've got to do is get the wheels down, and you want to get some flap out so that you can land at a slow speed. So at some stage, below 20,000 feet, you'll put the gear down maybe. If you think it's going to go off, you'll put the gear down and start getting the plane configured for landing, because then landing the wreck is most important. If you haven't got a time where, you want to fly really, really fast and be on the ground before it goes off. But if you're starting to get iffy and you think, right, this is really going to happen, then you'll configure the airplane early, provided you've got enough fuel. So you put the flap out and the gear down and flying at a low level to get the pressurization under, at the right levels, you're going to put about 2.1 times the fuel burn into the airplane, which is good for an airplane that doesn't have dumping. And, you're not going to get involved much, I don't think, in fuel dumping at this stage. You just want to get the thing on the ground in a hurry.
Yeah.
And a plane like an Airbus A380 or all the Airbus family will be able to land at the weight it took off on. So you don't really need to get the weight down. It's a very nice thing to do if you can, if you've got the time. But really, you want to get the thing down without and get the thing configured for landing and get it on the ground.
I find that remarkable. I'd love to go into more detail. I haven't got much time. But one thing else I learnt in the podcast was, what's the most stolen item on a commercial aircraft, James Nixon?
No, you're going to look. If I tell you again, I mean, this is the radio. No one listens to the podcast. We know that.
Millions of people have heard it.
Listen, if you're going to try and get me to say life jackets, I'm not going to tell them to do that because we won't mention that. Anyway, an aeroplane life jacket is no fun in a boat now because police look for them because they've got binoculars on the police launches. And it's just so much easier to go to Anaconda and get one of those $99 ones you wear as a waistcoat and it doesn't look like a life jacket until you pull the string. But yes, in the olden days, aeroplane life jackets were thieved quite regularly. And we found out about this because every cabin crew checks their area prior to the passengers getting on the plane. After the caterers have left the airplane's security sealed, so no one's allowed on it after then. And then they do the security check, which takes about 12 minutes. And every single area is checked. And of course, we're talking seat pockets. We're talking the whole airplane. And the person who has to do the galley, imagine all those on a big airplane like the A380, the galleys have all these carts in them. They've got to pull them out and make sure there's not a bomb or a gun or a knife taped in the, inside each one of them. So it takes 15 minutes probably before the area is checked completely. But you can bet that we're going to find out that the previous passenger stole the life jacket. And guess what? We know who you were.
Yeah. So I won't do it ever again. James Nixon, thank you so much. I'm much reassured by your explanations of what is a fairly fearsome topic. But
thank you
so much for your time.
Can I go back to bed now?
You can go back to bed, indeed.
Thank you.
It's retired A380 Captain James Nixon there on what happens when there's a bomb on a plane. Fortunately, it doesn't happen that much anymore. But the great thing is that the aircraft is designed for it. All the procedures are there. There's no reason why it should be the end of the story. Now, but tell me, have you had a scary experience on a plane? Give me a call and tell me the story. 133353. This is The Night Shift on Triple M.